The O'Leary Review Podcast, Episode 21. The O'Leary Review Podcast, bringing you conversations that matter. Get ready for serious content amidst an oftentimes unserious culture. All right, welcome back to the O'Leary Review Podcast. Today I have with me Laura Davidson. She's the author of a new book called The Logic of Freedom, Free Will, Human Nature, and the Rational Argument for a Genuinely Free World. And Laura is an author, researcher with a multidisciplinary approach in economics, philosophy, and libertarian ethics, who has been published in numerous peer-reviewed journals. She was also a recipient of the Lawrence Fertig Prize in Economics from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Laura is a frequent speaker at libertarian and economic research conferences, a graduate of Oxford University, where she studied earth science, but afterwards became interested in social sciences. And Laura emphasizes that the social and natural sciences employ very different methodologies, yet they can inform each other through a shared commitment to logical reasoning. Her book, The Logic of Freedom, strives for an integrated, holistic understanding of the world. And Laura, great to have you on finally. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
You
it's
bet.
Great to be with you.
All right. Yeah. So this book is a dense book, I would argue, number one. I have pages and pages of notes, but do you want to just give us an overview of the book? I mentioned that it strives for integrated, holistic understanding of the world, but maybe a little more light on what you mean there.
Yeah, it is a fairly dense book. I mean, it's a book on theory.
Sure.
And theory can be a little bit dense. I try to make it as readable as possible.
Uh-huh.
But it's one of those books where you really have to sort of start at the beginning and just go through it, because it's a logical argument. It's a chain of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to write a book essentially about why human beings are meant to be free.
Right.
Because I think we see our freedom sort of rapidly disappearing. And so I think, you know, that it starts actually, I think, with proving that we have free will.
Right.
And that's the first part of the book, dealing with free will. Because so many people today, scientists and philosophers,
uh-huh,
actually don't believe we have free will. They believe we live in a deterministic world, a world of physics, if you like,
right,
and that we don't have free will. So that's the first part of my book. I wanted to actually sort of try to prove that,
uh-huh,
from first principles.
Okay.
And then the second part of the book is to recognize that we do have certain human natures, mm-hmm, that we've retained from our evolutionary past, and we can't just sort of ignore that. We don't have sort of absolute, unlimited free will. We do have certain drives. Among them, among the strongest, are, of course, the will or the drive to live and to reproduce,
mm-hmm,
and that kind of thing. And then the final part of the book is to demonstrate the kind of laws that are consistent with life as a rational being. Mm. And to that end, I wanted to demonstrate the libertarian principle of non-aggression,
right,
which is really important. It's central to libertarianism. It's the idea that it is illegitimate to initiate force or threaten force against another human being or their property. But I wanted to show why that extends to all areas of life,
mm-hmm,
and not just in sort of theoretical terms, in sort of practical terms, and what that means for us as human beings.
Yeah, and you do quite a extensive job in explaining all this stuff. You know, since you just mentioned the non-aggression principle, people familiar with libertarian philosophy or even libertarian politics, the non-aggression principle, just as you said, but like to really get down to the nub of it, it's essentially don't hit me, don't take my stuff. Right.
Yes, exactly. As you know, as my friend and mentor, Walter Block likes, uh-huh, to say, keep your mitts off.
Right.
Basically, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Just don't tread on me, I guess you'd
say.
You
know? I think that's just basically decent behavior, human to human.
Yeah.
So Now, in this book,
and little children, actually,
sure,
they know this. You know, it's only as we get older that we somehow think that it's legitimate to exercise force or aggression against people, you know, under certain circumstances, and we make laws that do that. But the whole point of the non-aggression principle is that that's invalid.
I guess it's not necessarily to the point of the book, but obviously we live in a society where that is the case.
Yeah.
What's the motivation there if we know as essentially children or as young as we have consciousness that essentially don't hit and don't take my stuff, even though I've got two small children myself, they probably know this, yet they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's just...
Well, they do.
Yeah.
But of course, that's part of human nature.
Uh-huh.
But... I mean, they know it's wrong, I think, probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so intuitively, they know it's kind of wrong.
Sure.
But as we get older, we I think, become corrupted by various sort of ideologies that justify these kinds of aggressions.
Okay.
And in fact, I talk about that in my book, in the second part of my book, as to how that can happen. How do you get these false ideologies that can sort of permeate society? And when you get that kind of thing happening, you can get a society where your freedoms start disappearing. And I fear, you know, we see that going on today to a degree. I mean, it's, you know, obviously there are some countries where it's really bad. I mean, it hasn't got as bad here as it has in some places, but it's heading in the wrong direction, I think. And that was one of the motivations for me to write this book.
Right. And so at the beginning, you lay out like four essential pillars. You call it the determinism, compatibilism, indeterminism, and libertarian free will. And you say that there are essentially problems with all of these as kind of the framework or outlook to way to look on life. And you go through and explain each one in detail. Ultimately, the conclusion you come up with more or less is that libertarian idea of free will, but that's not necessarily the libertarian party explain that a little bit.
Well, when we talk about libertarian free will, yes, we do not mean the libertarian party,
right.
And we don't even mean the libertarian philosophy,
right.
It's just libertarian in that sense just is a sort of a way of describing the kind of free will that is the mutually exclusive from strict causal determinism. So you asked me to define them. Determinism, there are sort of various sort of shades of determinism.
Right.
But for me, determinism, if you're going to talk about strict determinism, it's the idea that, you know, all events, including human thoughts, are caused by physical processes.
Yeah.
So the determinists see the brain as a physical object, and it's a biological object, obviously, but biology can be reduced to chemistry, which can be reduced to physics. So basically what it means is the determinists think that our brain simply operates like a computer, like a one-to-one relationship, cause and effect. So in essence, we don't make any choices. It's just made for us by the laws of physics. That's strict causal determinism.
Yeah, and you bring up two historical examples, one being Martin Luther and the other being probably a better example of the determinism would be John Calvin with the philosophy of predestination, and you call it even fatalism.
Now we're talking about something else.
Okay.
Now we're talking about theological determinism.
Okay.
I'm talking about physical determinism.
Okay.
Yes, there is that kind of determinism as well, but that's rather kind of separate.
Okay.
I don't think too many people sort of subscribe to that these days.
Right, no.
But when we talk about strict causal determinism, we're mostly talking about not determinism caused by God, but the determinism caused by the laws of physics.
Okay, yeah. Brain as computer. Yeah, okay.
Precisely, yeah.
Okay.
And then there's the idea of compatibilism, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
And now compatibilism says that free will is compatible with determinism, but the compatibilists simply redefine what determinism means. So, you know, there's a certain amount of determinism in the things that we do, obviously. I mean, there's, you know, if I extend my hand to you in a friendly manner, you know, is that for a handshake? shake. You're probably going to shake my hand. And that's sort of predictable, but that's not what we really mean by determinism. Mm-hmm. But the compatibilists, so they redefine that, or else they define free will to mean freedom of action. But that's not what we mean by free will. When we talk about free will, we really mean the freedom to think, which is a completely different thing from the freedom to act. So even a slave.
Right. And reading through your book and you giving these examples, I think you're right in the way you define it. But I think for me anyway, the way I've been taught, I'm like, oh, yeah, I get David Hume's or Thomas Hobbes' idea of free will or freedom or whatever. That's what I've been taught. But you're saying that they redefine the term in order to kind of massage their own philosophy or...
Exactly. And a lot of present-day compatibilists do the same thing. They either redefine, they define the term, and that's fine. I mean, if you want to define a word, you know, determinism to mean the soft determinism instead of strict causal determinism, or you want to define free will as freedom of action, well, that's your prerogative, but, you know... Don't tell me how to define my words. My definition of free will is freedom to think. So even a slave has free will.
Sure.
They just can't act upon their will. And that's the difference. So for me, free will, the free will that I want to prove is mutually exclusive from determinism. It's the exact opposite of determinism.
Yeah. And I had it in my notes just from, it's interesting you mentioned that. I think you mentioned present day compatibilists. And I said, like, the problem with a lot of this stuff is our bias, like our recency bias or presentism, that we have all this material that we see through today's lens, not necessarily the lens that somebody in the 16th century was, you know, defining it in some other language, even perhaps. But what we're talking about is you define these four things, and then you also have indeterminism and libertarian free will. So why don't you brief on those two? So,
well, indeterminism is the idea that it's the idea that our brain is governed by quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. So that there's this is something that Stephen Hawking.
Right.
Subscribe to. It's the idea that our brain is influenced by random, indeterminate operations in the brain. Well, that's fine. You can say that, but obviously we don't act randomly.
Sure.
So obviously there has to be some kind of probabilistic mechanism.
Would those people say we do act randomly?
Yep.
Was that?
What's that?
Would those people say people we do?
Not, people don't act randomly, obviously.
I get that, so, and you get that, but are these people arguing that our thoughts and actions are in some way random?
Oh, no. What I'm saying is because we don't act randomly, therefore there must be some kind of probabilistic operation going on in the brain.
Right.
And if you accept that there's going to be some kind of probabilist, I'm more probable to do one thing than another thing. I'm more probable to sit here and talk with you than I am to go over to the back of the room and stand on my head. Obviously, something is determining that.
Yeah,
so therefore, you get back to the determinist argument again.
Okay.
So you can't escape that. Either you believe that the reason that I'm sitting here is because I'm of my free will, or it's because of some kind of deterministic operation. But so that really, the indeterminism really doesn't solve the issue for me. Now, the problem, of course, that leaves free will, libertarian free will, the idea that we have freedom of thought. But the problem with free will, and you know, I readily admit there's a problem there, is that we live in a world of cause and effect. How can I be the cause of my thoughts? How can thoughts be the first cause of themselves? And so while you can point out all the inconsistencies with determinism, and determinism has a lot of inconsistencies because, you know, why determinists ever bother to convince us of anything if everything's determined? You know, if we live in a completely determined world, then there's no point trying to do anything. There's no point to act even.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of inconsistencies with determinism, but there's also problems with free will. And so it's necessary to point out the deficiencies in determinism, but it's not sufficient to prove free will. And so that was the rest of the first part, is mm-hmm. trying to prove that we actually do have free will.
Yeah. So I had a question that came up as I was reading. I said, does a free world, now that we want a free world, does that necessitate a free politics or a free government? Or are we just talking about interpersonal relationships between others? Is that bigger picture of politics or who rules us? Is that part of the whole thing?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the argument that I'm trying to make here. When I talk about a genuinely free world, I mean a world where a free society, where you have a free society, mm-hmm. that's the sort of final part of the book. Is trying to demonstrate why we should have a free society based on the non-aggression principle.
Right.
Because, you know, libertarians talk about the non-aggression principle, but they don't really kind of explain why we should believe in the non-aggression principle. I mean, why should we strictly apply this principle? And this principle is the idea that it's illegitimate, wrong, morally mm-hmm. wrong, to initiate force or threaten force against another human being or their property. And if you extrapolate all these sort of bad things to do that you shouldn't do, right? Why should we strictly believe in the implementation of that principle?
Yeah, I think
that libertarians never answer that, really. I mean, they'll say, "Oh well, it makes, you know, it's great, better for the social welfare or something like this." But they never really get to the crux of it. And that's what I wanted to try to do in this book.
Right. And I think that a lot of people would say, or a lot of libertarians anyway, would say that it's axiomatic almost for human beings to believe in the non-aggression principle, just because, like what you said earlier, little kids inherently understand it. But the problem is, like, is the way we live in the world that this gets corrupted as we get older.
Absolutely.
And so we have to then teach this principle later on in life. And so it's been, say, corrupted, in other words. And we have to then teach this, or even this is where it gets kind of hairy. Are you going to force the non-aggression principle on people? Is that libertarian in and of itself? That becomes an interesting question or argument even.
Well, I would argue that to force the non-aggression principle is a contradiction.
Right.
You can't actually, because the non-aggression principle is a rejection of force. It's it's when you don't implement the non-aggression principle that you're forcing your views on somebody.
Kind of a conundrum.
So no, I don't subscribe to that idea. But but I think that you do have to prove it, because mm-hmm. You said that it's sort of people intuitively know it's correct, but that doesn't actually, just because you intuit something doesn't actually prove that you should follow it.
Right.
So I think it's more than just intuition. I think you have to demonstrate it rationally.
Mm-hmm.
And the defining characteristic of human beings is that we are rational animals.
Mm-hmm.
Other animals, or animals, don't have ratiocination. They can't think the way that we do.
Yeah.
They don't have ideas. They don't have self-awareness. They don't have an ego. And therefore, I maintain, they don't have free will. It's the fact that we have free will. It's the fact that we are rational animals.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we should subscribe to the non-aggression principle. Animals don't have morality.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't impose the non-aggression principle on an animal. When a lion is coming towards you, you can't say to the lion, "Hey, look, eating me is wrong." It's not going to work.
Yeah, he's hungry.
Because they can't.
She's hungry.
I mean, not only because they don't have language, but even if they had language,
uh-huh.
it would mean nothing to them. And it's true also that if you look at the development of a human being from, you know, birth to adulthood, we don't impose morality on children, on very small children.
Mm.
And why do we not? Because small children are actually not self-aware. A baby mm-hmm. or a toddler is really not self-aware, doesn't have reason, can't think in rational terms, and therefore doesn't even have an ego. Or a free will for that matter.
Define ego for us in that context.
A sense of self-awareness.
Self-awareness. Yeah. Okay.
So animals and very small children have bodily awareness. They're aware of their own bodies, but they're not aware of their own mind. So there's actually a test that you can give to small children. It's called the false belief task. In this test, you take a small child, and in front of a child, you put a marble in a box.
Okay.
And then the person who puts the marble in the box leaves the room, and another person comes in and takes the marble out of the box and puts it in another box, and in full view of the child. And then the original person comes back in, and you ask the child, where's that first person going to look for the marble? Is it going to be in the first box or the second box? Now, a very young child will say the second box, because the young child doesn't realize that the person the adult coming back into the room has a mind separate from their own. So they think it's in the same box that they know it's in. But about the age of 4 or 5, a child will realize, well, okay, that person has their own mind. They think it's in the first box. I know it's in the second box, but they think it's in the first box.
Okay.
And that demonstrates that they realize that their mind is separate from the other person's mind. But that happens at about 4 or 5. And before that, you know, they're not really self-aware. And it develops slowly over time. So until about the age of 4 or 5. And then, you know, reason, which is all part of tied in with this, the ability to reason, develops further as you get older. And you're probably not fully rational until you're an adult, until you're about 25 years old.
Okay.
And that's when you really become a full adult.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that gives some credence to the laws anyway, that where you had to be 21 to vote or 35 to be president of the United States or so on and so forth, because the people tended to consider these things a bit more back in the day, so-called. I came across a quote because I was, two things, but one was interesting by kind of a proto-libertarian, H.L. Mencken, and he said there was a time where a man of sound sense and fair education could understand all the concepts commonly employed in the physical sciences, and even most of those used in the speculative sciences. And he goes on, but he just said, like, it's been either muddy. He didn't go into the reasons, but like, this is, he's writing literally a century ago. This was from June 1923. And, but it's been all muddied up, and there's been specialization, and we kind of see it in the last 3 years, especially like trust the experts, trust the scientists, and all this stuff, where you should, as a rational member of society, probably be able to figure a lot of these things out on your own. And I think that was the goal. And I think what you're getting at here in this book is that we're all rational enough beings to see this idea of the non-aggression principle be utilized, or at least perhaps laws interpret, if we can't get to that ideal state, which I don't know if we can, laws should probably be interpreted with the non-aggression principle in mind, and they're still not interpreted in that manner. So I don't know what you would say to that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, people, as I was mentioning before, I think that we are, you know, obviously we are rational animals, but we're not completely rational. and we do get influenced by various sort of, we get influenced by advertising, for example. We get influenced by just other people's ideas. We get influenced from propaganda. Some people are subject to indoctrination. So all of these things can influence our thinking. Ultimately, though, we do have free will. Ultimately, no matter how much you've been indoctrinated, no matter how much you've been propagandized, or whatever, you know, ultimately, you do have the choice. You don't have to. Your thoughts are not controlled by somebody else, right, ultimately. I mean, unless you have some sort of severe mental disorder or something like that.
Yeah. Is it axiomatic being a human being to have free will? Would you argue that? Is that where?
Oh, yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Absolutely. That's.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's how that's the defining characteristic of a human being.
Right.
Is to have free will. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that. Yeah, all these other philosophical abstractions, almost, they try and get away from this point, but forgetting that at the core of it all, we do have free will. And then, like you were saying earlier, the definitional changes and the propaganda and everything else becomes kind of ultimately a power play where we don't ever ultimately get to the truth and the kind of the idealized reality of where we want to go with this, but.
Well, I think what's so important is to recognize when we are being propagandized. Mm. And you mentioned the last 3 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of people, and myself included, have had their eyes sort of opened as to just how subject to propaganda and misinformation. I mean, they call a lot of the things that a lot of good people are saying is misinformation, but really a lot of what we hear, you know, coming out of the mainstream media, in my opinion, a lot of it is misinformation. Exactly. Yeah, that.
These are just labels.
I'm sorry?
These are just labels that somebody wants to, it's like I said earlier, a power play almost. Like misinformation?
Oh,
what is that?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
It is a power play. Yeah. No, there's no question that that's exactly what it is, because we live in a world where people, ultimately, they don't want to abide by the non-aggression principle. What they want is power. They want to exercise power over others. And one way to do that is to propagandize people. And we have to sort of move away from that. We have to sort of recognize it for what it is, because people are subject to a lot of false sort of ideologies. And it can be very, very dangerous. And, you know, in the second part of my book, I talk about how false ideologies can spread, and it can lead to totalitarianism, and you know, certain bad people, you know, psychopaths and sociopaths and narcissists and people like this can manipulate others, who, you know, can and that can lead to totalitarianism. One of the great writers on totalitarianism was Hannah Arendt. And she wrote a book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. And she talked about how when people feel isolated and atomized, they can easily be exploited. It can lead to a totalitarian kind of ideology. And she said that totalitarian ideologies always have some sort of grand explanation for the way in which the world works, but it's all built upon false premises.
Okay, yeah.
And all the facts have to conform with the ideology, even if they're completely irrational. Mm-hmm. But under certain conditions, people can believe that. There's another writer, actually. I don't know if you've heard of Matthias Desmet.
I've heard the name. I'm not all that familiar.
He's the one who's sort of made a name during the COVID pandemic, because he talks about mass formation, and he talks about how when people feel a deep sense of isolation and they have no meaning in life and they have a lot of anxiety and non-specific anger, they can be easily formed into a crowd, a sort of a mass, and all that's needed is a trigger, and he talks about the trigger being fear, or one trigger being fear. And he said that, you know, basically during the COVID pandemic, this was fearful for a lot of people, and who felt this sort of sense of isolation and anxiety, and by focusing on that, it sort of they sort of felt this sort of belonging to this group, And, you know, these were the kinds of sort of people that wanted to sort of enforce mask mandates and mandatory vaccinations and all this kind of thing. You know, so, and...
Whoever knew that angst was a fuel, you know, it seems like...
Fear is a fuel for a lot of bad things, right. I think.
So, you know, with this whole argument, I don't even know if it's down the right road, but it reminds me, I think it was Benjamin Franklin or some, I don't know, it may be apocryphal, but rather than having liberty, people would want to be safe. I think Mencken said something about to the effect.
I think it was Franklin, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't.
Yeah. It might be apocryphal,
People who give up essential liberty for safety, I this is just paraphrasing, will find they end up with neither.
Sure. Basically. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think, you know, the idealism of freedom or free will is something that a lot of us have, but there's a lot of people that don't recognize that at all. And they're just trying to get by and trying to be safe. And we're talking up here kind of in the intellectual clouds to some degree, where people just need to have a shelter over them and have food and be safe. And that's a hard juxtaposition, right? In society that we live in.
I totally agree. But, you know, so much of what we believe in originates with the theory, you know, from the.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it. You have to have the theory to have.
I think it was Keynes. You know, the economist, Maynard Keynes.
That's a cuss word in my house. Said,
what's that?
That's a cuss word in my house.
That's a cuss word. I agree. But he said so few people, and this is a paraphrasing, but he said so few, I think it was him, he said so few people realize how much their lives are influenced by some dead economist.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the truth with him for sure. I mean,
exactly. So, I mean, you know, it's like, it's important that we talk about this stuff, you know, because, you know, you look around the world and you see, well, why is the world becoming, you know, less, or seem to be becoming, you know, less moral? Why are we facing all these issues?
Right.
It's philosophy. It comes back to the philosophy. It comes out of the universities. You know?
Yeah. And I would say, and after thinking about this a little bit, I would say that essentially government has devolved over the centuries. I don't know if anybody shares that opinion, but I also mentioned earlier that we come at this in this presentism or recency bias, and we just see this, you know, like, it's getting worse. You know, we're not having as much freedom as we did, but there's another argument to be had that hardly any human being was free up until, I don't know, maybe even the inventing of the printing press or something. There's some point in human history where we were more free than we were in the past. I don't know if this is an evolution or a devolution. I'm really not sure. I think it's hard to say the human race that this is the case, where there's certain individual cultures or societies where it ebbs and flows to some degree. I don't know about the human race as a whole. That seems like next book.
I think you can say that most of human history has been pretty close to slavery.
Yeah.
With a few bright spots where there's a little bit of freedom. And I think if you look at it, you know, I think Western civilization has come under so much criticism lately, unjustified criticisms, criticism mostly. It's a great shame because, you know, the Enlightenment, which was a period from about 1600 onwards, was a great burgeoning of freedom. And why? Because it was the age of reason. They called it the age of reason. You know, I fear that we're going back into the age of emotion. And when your decisions, particularly political decisions, are made by emotion, by feelings, instead of just rational thinking, then you're headed for trouble, in my view. So
sounds like you've been listening to my podcast. No. I say these things quite often, and I always wonder if I'm the lone wolf out there barking these things. But clearly, we've got other folks who believe similar things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you talk about how we're losing our freedom. Yeah, I think we definitely are less free. We're becoming less free. Mm. Because we are moving to that sort of emotion-based society instead of a rational society. And the other thing that I talk about also is virtue, because virtue is really important. We haven't really sort of gone in much to the crux of the the book, the third part of the book,
right?
But the I think there's this concept. I introduced this concept of entropy.
Right. Yeah.
And entropy is essentially it's a physical. It's a concept in physics.
Sure.
But entropy is the degree of disorder, randomness, and uncertainty within a system.
Mm-hmm.
And in physics, we know that if you take the universe as a whole, entropy is increasing. It's just a fundamental fact of the universe that disorder, randomness, and uncertainty is increasing. But where you can harness energy, you can reverse entropy, at least temporarily. You can create order out of chaos. And our whole living things are negative entropy, if you like. They reverse entropy.
We
create order out of chaos, order in our bodies from disordered matter. We eat food, which is energy. Mm-hmm. Plants get it from the sun.
Sure.
Animals get it from eating plants, and chemical energy from plants. And we create order out of chaos. And that is what life is. Life is about creating order. Now, eventually we die and decompose and entropy increases, but the species continues. We reproduce. Sure. And we keep order going through by reproduction, but our entire civilizations, in fact, are about creating order out of chaos, lowering entropy, countering entropy.
Yeah.
But we also counter a different kind of entropy. This isn't physical entropy, but we also counter disorder and randomness and uncertainty in our thoughts, in our minds. We don't want to have a disordered minds. We don't want to have uncertainty. And I maintain that a state of long-term happiness is really countering mental entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And the question then becomes is, well, how do we go about doing that? And I think that the key to that is by employing not physical laws like we do with the physical world, but by employing laws that we impose on ourselves in the form of self-discipline. So by having self-discipline, we can string together actions that create order in our lives. The Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he wrote a book called 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, which is really, that's what it's about.
He
talks about self-discipline and creating order in your life by having self-discipline. And that's a very different kind of law that one imposes on oneself. It's subjective, but it is a kind of a law.
Right.
And in that sense, we are sort of law-seeking and order-creating beings as rational beings. That's what we do in life. And the question then becomes,
I think it's a hard lesson for people to get through. Like, what is the degree of self-discipline versus total, almost chaotic freedom that you like thrive in?
Well, chaotic freedom is nice in the short term.
Yes, true.
And I wouldn't call it freedom, actually. I'd call it temporary happiness.
Okay, that's a great point.
A drug addict or a drunk can get temporary happiness.
Yeah,
by not having the self-discipline to stop drinking or to not take drugs.
Right.
But it doesn't lead to long-term happiness in the long run, does it?
Not at all. Yeah.
So, It can make you temporarily happy, but it's not good in the long run. And so you need self-discipline to counter that, to counter those impulsive feelings, that those animalistic feelings, if you like, that we sometimes have. And only a rational being can do that. I mean, an animal can't impose self-discipline on itself. Only human beings can do that.
The lion's not going to the gym at 5:30 in the morning every day. You know,
no, he's not.
He's just not doing that.
He's not doing that.
Yeah.
So then the question does become, well, how do you find that self-discipline? How do you, because it is subjective, how do you know what to do? And this is where I think virtue comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And virtue here is a very old concept. I mean, it goes back to the time of the ancient Greeks. And the ancient Greeks viewed virtue as an end in itself. And they outlined basically four cardinal virtues, which were to them essential, but they outlined wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. So they said, well, you need wisdom to know what kind of rules to impose on yourself. You need courage to impose them, because sometimes there's a lot of things that might tempt you the other way. You need temperance or moderation so that you don't go overboard. And justice is important because you need fairness in your dealings with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, there are other virtues like kindness and beneficence and generosity and things like that. But without those four cardinal virtues, you won't have the self-discipline to have the other virtues, is their argument. And I think this is really important because I think virtue really sort of is sort of not prominent in thinking today. And a lot of people, they want to appear virtuous, but they don't want to actually be virtuous.
Virtue signaling
wisdom,
is the
courage, temperance.
Yeah. We have virtue signaling in our society.
Yeah, we call
it
virtue signaling. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Making sure that people know you're on the right side. And I see a lot of that these days. Well, any tips?
Exactly.
Any tips on more self-discipline in one's life? I know that's a constant battle for me, and I've got all sorts of methods. But do you have any tips or ideas on how to improve that in one's life?
Well, I think, you know, everybody has to find it for themselves.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that you have to sort of develop your virtue.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to become wise. You have to have that, you have to find that courage.
Sure.
And you need to moderate what you do, and you need to be fair in your dealings with other people.
Okay.
I mean, all those things, you have to somehow find that. And only you can find it, because only you have the will,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do it.
Right.
You know, You're not governed by the laws of physics. It's not inevitable that you can't find that the virtue necessary to have that self-discipline to lead a flourishing life. The Greeks used to call that eudaimonia.
Right.
Eudaimonia meant flourishing, human flourishing.
EU. I highlighted that in my book. Although I love having the Kindle version of your book. I said I could take it pretty much anywhere and read it and highlight it. The problem is I don't have the thick thing with, I can just go to my notes and my flags. I'm not very good at the Kindle usage. So I have to write all these things down. And if it doesn't come up in my 10 pages of notes, then I have to go find it later. But I think this is a good start for everyone here to get into your book. And one other quick thing I wanted to ask you, since you are in the Tom Woods School of Life like I am, I ask everybody that's been on the show from the Tom Woods School, just kind of your story, relationship, how you got into the Tom Woods School. It doesn't have to be, can be two sentences, you can go on for 15 minutes. I'm just curious more than anything.
Well, because, you know, I think that as a libertarian,
mm-hmm.
A philosophical libertarian, I should say, not for libertarian party, but a philosophical libertarian, somebody who believes in the non-aggression principle. Mm-hmm. You know, one finds oneself in today's world rather a sort of a bit of a unicorn.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't that many of us around.
Uh-huh.
And so I joined the Tom Woods School to be able to communicate with other people, like-minded people, and sort of bounce ideas around, just like I'm doing with you now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't have found you had it not been for the Tom Woods School.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was my reason for joining.
Okay.
Yeah, that's basically
it. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I had somebody else that had a very similar story that said, you know, I was just kind of lonely because I didn't know anybody that was like me. And I said, well, you picked like the Lonely Hearts Club and here we are.
It is kind of like that. Yeah. So. No, but it's been very fruitful and rewarding, I think. So, it's been good. And Tom Woods is great. I mean, he's very learned.
Oh yeah.
And he has a great podcast
which you were on a couple of weeks ago, if I recall.
I was on his podcast. Yeah. I think actually we got a bit too thick. We got really into the weeds with that one, but maybe a little too much into the weeds, I should say, but I mean, it's been a great experience.
Oh, great. All right. We'll have a link to that show with Tom. We'll have links to your book. Any website that you have?
I don't have a website, actually.
So we'll just point you to the Amazon page for your book.
If people want to see my other work, they can go to the Mises website, Mises.org.
Yeah, I'll have a link to that.
Mises.org. And just type in, or you can just Google my name and Laura Davidson Economics or Laura Davidson Philosophy will get it. Show up a lot of my stuff.
And Laura's no joke, folks. Like, you know, Tom was quite impressed to have Laura on his show, I think. So that was nice to see, as am I, with all the stuff I've read about you and by you, including this long tome.
It's not that long, is it?
Yeah, well, maybe not. I don't know.
It's about 230 pages, okay. I think.
I have
so it's
no,
not that bad.
That's a great point, because I have no idea how long books are when I read them on Kindle.
Oh, because you're looking on Kindle. The paperback version is 230 pages, and it's nice big type, too. Okay. It's not like little tiny writing.
Okay, because I just see on my Kindle, I have like, you're at like page like 16,000 of whatever it is, and I'm like, still like, I don't know how much I have to go. 16,000 just seems like to be a large number, but I have that with a lot of Kindle stuff, so maybe I'm a little more intimidated because I like to see the thickness of the books. But all right, Laura, it's been great having you, and like I said, we'll link to all that stuff, and it's been a wonderful conversation. I'm happy to finally meet you. And any last words?
It's been fun. No, it's been great. I will say that you know, I think there's one thing that that one can't ignore, that I think there's a sort of spiritual aspect of this. Now, I'm not a particularly religious person.
Okay.
But I think that there are certain eternal truths and absolute truths. And one of them, of course, is the non-aggression principle. But there are many others concerning things like virtue and stuff like that. And so I sort of briefly touch on that aspect of it as well. Yeah. I mean, most of my book is on logic and reasoning, but I do bring up a sort of spiritual aspect to all of this, because I think that when you find eternal truths, it's a moment of it's a moment of joy, and I think it goes beyond the physical realm into the sort of the transcendental. I don't want to get transcendental. I don't want to get too philosophical.
No,
but I think, you know, even if you don't believe in God, but if you believe in truth, and then I think that brings you that this process of discovery, in discovering absolute truths, is a really important thing. And I think it gives meaning to life. And, religious people will say God is truth, and I think that's right. You know, when we grasp that truth, we become one with God, and I think that's a really interesting
concept. I find it really interesting you bring that up, because early on in the book you mention St. Thomas Aquinas,
yes,
and how he has a lot of attributes in the way he thinks with compatibilism. God, I'm struggling with that word. Compatibilism.
No, but I don't think he is a compatibilist.
But yeah, you said no. Yeah. And I went back and I started reading a little more Aquinas, and I'm like, all right, well, yeah, Laura is right. But that's the kind of framework, I guess. I don't know. I guess that I was kind of taught or read into early on that essentially it is this kind of intermixing of the libertarian free will and the compatibilism.
Hmm. Well, one thing I will say about Aquinas is that, you know, probably the greatest libertarian ever was Murray Rothbard.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a big fan of Thomas Aquinas.
Right.
And Aristotle.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, And you mentioned, I know you mentioned Aristotle and Plato, and you lean more Aristotle, Plato. I don't know well enough to like come out either way, but all this stuff, I'm just telling you, all this stuff, just when I first read your stuff, then going back over it, I'm like, man, there's just too much. I don't even know how to deal with this. And then, you know, you take a step back from it and you start going and reading more stuff, tying it back into your book, or like coming up with thoughts of your own, and like, holy cow, we are human beings and we can think for ourselves. We have free will. How about it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's been great. And I appreciate your time, Laura. And we will, like I said, link to all your stuff, and we shall talk to you later.
Yeah. And the book is The Logic of Freedom, and it's available on Amazon.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. I really enjoyed it.
You bet. Thanks again for taking your time to listen to the O'Leary Review podcast. And for more resources and links to all my stuff, briandoleary.com is where you'll find me. We have links for our Substack page and more. Again, that's briandoleary.com.